The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of News You Can Use. I'm Ann Baldwin with you this morning, and thanks for coming along on this conversation. And today we're going to talk about some interesting things when it comes to cold cases here in the state of Connecticut. We've got Lieutenant Art Weisgerber, and he is with Norwalk Police Department, and he's also a trainer for Specter Criminal Justice Training Network, and we're going to get into all this. So, Lieutenant, thank you for being here. Why don't you share with our listeners a little bit of your background? I mean, I've got your bio in front of me, and it's pretty impressive.
So when I was first hired as a patrolman, I kind of worked in a narcotics unit, and then in 1998 was promoted to detective and received the proper training for that position. And then we formed in 2002 a cold case unit with a lieutenant and two detectives. So kind of started there, and a lot of that was the organization of the cold cases and kept them as a sergeant. And then even when I moved into the crime scene unit, I still continued to work on cold cases until about 2018. And then we actually formed over the Detective Bureau a larger squad of four with a sergeant and three detectives.
So how many cold cases do you know are there in Connecticut?
That I would have no idea, and part of the reason I say that is a lot of departments don't have them on their websites. So what I had done when I was working cold cases, not only do we organize them internally, but then I started to put a flyer together that would put a picture of the victim, if we had one, with a synopsis and a summary of the case up on our website under a cold case tab. So that way the public at any time could kind of click on and take a look to see what were cold cases in case they had any information or knew something about it.
Well, you know, that's kind of unfortunate, isn't it? Because, you know, you want to keep these things relevant. You want to at least have a resource for people to revisit them, because I would guess that over time, you know, the people who might have the information, they're no longer with us.
It's actually a couple of different issues. It's over time, some of the people who are witnesses and have information are no longer fearful of coming forward because the dynamics of the neighborhood have changed. Maybe the suspect hasn't been seen in 15 years in that area, or the witness has moved somewhere else. So a lot of times I find sometimes if you go back and talk to people that were involved in a case originally, they're not even familiar that the case was still open or unsolved.
I see. You know, and it's I would think that, you know, having a cold case on your desk, you know, in any department is consuming, right? It's just time consuming there's not a lot of resources out there, and time is huge.
Yeah, so that's the biggest problem with the cold cases is A, what decade did it occur in? Mm-hmm. And then when you're starting to organize them and start to investigate it, you have to kind of go back and put yourself in that decade of what was going on, what the forensic capabilities were at the time, what the relationship between people were. That all changes and becomes different as far as who was dating, no longer dating. So the evaluation of what witnesses you need to talk to now compared to 20 years ago is just a ton of work to organize it and kind of triage them as far as which ones are interview talking to people for information and which ones have forensic work that needs to be done because the evidence was collected but may not have been processed back then to today's capabilities.
Where is all this evidence held, and how long is it held on to for usually in a cold case?
So for murders, they're held forever. So there's actually statutory record retentions that you cannot get rid of or destroy homicide because there's no statute of limitations on it. So that stuff is and should be held indefinitely.
Where? Is there are there warehouses everywhere?
No, ours. Usually they're in the departments, and they're actually in the property division. So, and that's also the problem as departments grow over time, and we moved into a new building in 2005, and probably one-third of the first floor holds just the property evidence room.
Unbelievable. So you've been in this for a long time, and you also train other officers and folks in law enforcement in this thing. But let's talk a little bit about some of the high-profile cases that you've worked on. Some have been solved, and some haven't. Talk a little bit about that.
So probably one of the first ones I got involved in was back in 2002. It was the Carlos Baradas homicide in South Norwalk. And this one was a little more interesting because the victim and what became the suspect were both out of Mamaroneck Village, New York. Had almost nothing to do with Norwalk whatsoever. So you're starting out with a homicide and you're kind of behind the eight ball already because you don't even know who the people are or why they're even in Norwalk. And it was worked on for a little bit. They had a person of interest, but it really couldn't go any further than that just because no witnesses came forward and had no real evidence to go after. So I assumed the investigation, and one of the things we did with the suspect is we did multiple search warrants for phone records.
Mm-hmm.
And back then we had to do actual search warrants. And you get the information of the person of interest phone number, and then we could follow the cell towers as they traveled that night from Mamaroneck Village up to Norwalk and then back to Portchester. So we already had put the suspect in the area, kept on doing further work, and then the suspect was arrested by Mamaroneck Village police for narcotics and sent to Westchester County Jail. So I started listening to his jail calls, which is legal because the phones actually are all labeled that the phone calls are being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking to friends and so forth, but I find out that he actually has another girlfriend on the side for his other girlfriend that he has a child with. And actually, she's pregnant at the time. So I kept on listening, and they didn't really talk much about the actual homicide or anything like that, but I found they were constantly talking about his baby's mother, which was, her name was Melissa, and making fun of her. And we had tried interviewing her initially with the drug charge case. She provided some information, but really not enough to get a probable cause to arrest the suspect. So then once I had some information, I went and visited her again probably about 2 years later and spoke with her and actually played some of the recordings of
them
suspect,
making fun of her.
Making fun of her and telling how she's stupid and so forth.
Yeah, there you go.
And at that point, she told me she was aware that something was going on because she saw the name signed into the visitor log at the jail. So then she goes, well, what do you want to know? So at that point, I'm like, everything. So she wrote out a 3-page statement in my car in front of her house that filled in all the gaps of the information she had provided 2 years earlier. And some of that was after the murder, right after the murder occurred in Norwalk, the suspect Solomon Boyd had called her and told her to call his sister on his apartment phone. That way he'd have an alibi that he was on the phone with his sister at the time.
Ah.
And she refused to do that. And then also she told me that she knew she left with the victim, Carlos, but then when he came home later, he wasn't with Carlos, and he was wearing different clothing. And then she asked, where is Carlos? And he goes, where do you think he is? I shot him 10 times. And that was the exact number of casings at the scene. And then she asked, why are you wearing that different sweatshirt? And he said, to get rid of the gunshot evidence.
Yeah, case closed.
No, so she tied in everything. Then it also confirmed the phone records of his travel times, time leaving, time arriving back. And then she had all the other information in between and testified in court against him. And he was convicted.
And that's all you need. And wasn't that one of the first cases where cell phone data was actually used to show proximity to the murder, one of the first ones.
It was actually used in the conviction of to show the travel path, time, and so forth, and like the time of the shots fired coming into 911 in Norwalk also matched his phone calls on his phone going to voicemail. Because it's kind of hard to do two things at once while you're shooting a 45.
Apparently.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
To take incoming calls.
Interesting. We're speaking with Lieutenant Art Weisberger with the Norwalk Police Department and with Spectre Training. You know, you've had some, but that just kind of points, Lieutenant, to all the time and effort, you know, literally years, right? Things change. You talked about how dynamics change, relationships change. But it's so hard to keep going, I would assume, because there's so many other things consuming your time within police departments across the country that, you know, to sit behind your desk and go out on the road and work on cold cases it's probably not a priority.
So I find that what I've noticed over the years, it kind of becomes cyclical, where something will come along and then a case will be solved, and then there's like a push to start doing more cold case work, and then if the resources are available, a team will be put together, they'll work it for maybe a couple of years, and then again there's resource issues again. Manpower is reallocated, and then you're going to lose your cold case as one of your first extra type of units to go back into the bureau and handle, you know, day-to-day call and call volume. So that's usually what happens is, and then a lot of departments kind of work them part-time.
Right.
If they're able to. So, but the problem is, You lose time on these cases if they're work part-time.
Well, you know, and you see on television, I'm sure it drives you crazy, you know, all these different programs, you know, from Dateline and crime shows. But one of the things that I see, it's usually when the family stays on top of it, right, keeps pushing for resolution, pushing, showing their face and making those calls and let's figure out who did this. I'm sure that has some impact on the priority system.
It will. It's the old saying, squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Yeah.
So, no, exactly. That's correct as far as the victim family almost being an advocate. But actually, the cold case investigator is actually the victim advocate, you know, to kind of keep this going and keep working it the best you can. And like you say, there's always solvability factors in these cases. And you kind of have to make sure you hit them, and then do you have them or not, and just kind of work it the best you can. And that's why I say some cases are very difficult where there's not a lot of forensic evidence involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally just re-interviewing people. And I found over the years sometimes, too, you go knock on a door again, you find a person that hasn't been talked to in 15 years, and then you start asking them some questions, and they give you a tremendous amount of information. And then they ask, why didn't you tell anybody this? And then they're like, because I was never asked.
Yeah, there you go.
It's literally they just, until you knock on a door again, you got to make recontact and speak with them.
Yep. Talk a little bit about one of the open cold cases in Connecticut of Maria, a 14-year-old runaway.
So in 1976, Maria Angiris was 14 years old and lived up on Mid Rocks in Norwalk. And neighbors heard her and her father in an argument. And she apparently took like one change of clothing, got on her bicycle and rode away and didn't return home in a couple of hours when she's supposed to have some music lessons and stuff like that. And it wasn't probably till later on in that evening, later, like 9 or 10, that the family kind of thought someone was up and called the police and reported her missing. The only thing that was interesting about that case initially was she was missing, and then there'd be sightings of her in town at certain restaurants or certain areas, and people didn't call right away because they figured she ran away for a day or two and then was back home and no big deal, but she still hadn't returned home. And then all this information was always like 2 or 3 days late, because then when the police were going around doing a canvas again, if anybody had saw her, like, yeah, I just saw her 2 days ago sitting over here in this booth, but I didn't think anything of it. Like, so there's like this first couple of weeks kind of like chasing the tail as far as the information's coming a little bit late, and then she's never returned. So that kind of, they worked it a little bit, and then it kind of went dormant after about 2 years. And I think part of it was kind of just the file got between the Youth Bureau and the Detective Bureau, because when she would have turned 16, and really not a lot of work was done then.
And it's never been solved?
No, it kind of slipped through the cracks. So when I picked it up and started working it, one of the things I started trying to look at was, you know, you're looking for dental records and DNA, and the detectives back in 76 had identified the family dentist and were going to go get the records, but they never did. So there was no dental records from to use for unidentified humans. So what you're trying to match up a missing person to possibly unidentified human remains somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to try to do it through fingerprints, dental records, or, you know, back then you weren't doing DNA. It's not until now. That's actually the other thing that's becoming more prevalent in some of these unsolved cases is exhumation of the Jane Does and John Does to grab DNA samples to do genetic DNA genealogy work.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not so much, you can do DNA if there's enough for it, if a family reported them missing and there's sibling samples in the database, but some of them aren't. So that's why forensic genealogy is starting to grow as a technique to try to hone in on family members and kind of circle in to, does anybody know of a missing family member type of thing.
Right. Well, and you got to, you know, especially with your historical perspective, you know, getting into the department in 1988, you've got to be thankful for all the things that have changed as far as forensics and DNA and even fingerprints. Talk a little bit about how you share your expertise and your knowledge from being in the field for so long with other law enforcement officials across the state through Spectre.
So what I have found in the training I've been doing of newer detectives or detectives in for the first couple of years and some officers, everybody's kind of gone to just swabbing for DNA and touch DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So the only problem I have to explain to them and why you should have the same protocol when you do any type of evidence work is you always need to do fingerprint work first. It identifies where areas were touched, and then you can swab that for touch DNA and not have a mixture that might not be usable. But the other issue is the national database for fingerprints is about 168 million files.
Wow.
The national DNA database is only about 20.2 million. So you have an 8 times better chance of making a fingerprint identification than you would with DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody who's just relying on swabbing for DNA is actually missing evidence and cutting down their opportunity to make identifications by doing fingerprint work first, and you supplement it with DNA. Unless you have blood visible at the scene, you're going to go right to swabbing, but you should still be doing fingerprint work because that person the suspect name may not be in the DNA database, but there's a better chance they're in the fingerprint. And a great example of that is, we just had it this past summer, upstate New York. There was the 7 or 9 year old girl was kidnapped in the campground, and the suspect then dropped off the ransom note in the parents' mailbox. Within an hour and a half, the New York State Police had him identified through fingerprints from a DUI arrest, which he was fingerprinted, but they don't take DNA samples for DUI.
Mm.
So they would have never identified him if they just swabbed the envelope and didn't do fingerprint work. So everybody's like, it's like this newer generation of investigators, and it's kind of like the path of least resistance, and it's cleaner just to do swabbing than it is to use dusting powder, because dusting powder is pretty much chimney soot that you're, you know, you end up all over you and all that type of stuff when you use it, especially if you're doing door frames and window frames and so forth.
Right. And you know, they have training. They have, you know, a lot of these people go to these different academies and stuff, but I'm sure it's kind of refreshing for them to be able to be educated, you know, through Spectre with folks who actually have on the job experience.
So when you go to police academy, your crime scene training is 8 hours.
That's it?
Out of 26 weeks.
Wow.
That's it. It's like an elective. Because don't forget, the focus at the police academy is you're putting out patrol officers. Not everybody's going to become a detective.
Right.
So they're not doing processing of evidence and scenes and stuff like that. So what happens is your initial training is 8 hours of crime. You're not taught how to do any of this stuff for the most part. You then need to go get supplemental education as you're in training, as you're working. So over my years, like just for photography, I started with 35 millimeter cameras. Then we thought we were hot stuff when we started using Mavica Sonys with a floppy disk. and then you're going to, you know, Nikon DSLR cameras and doing stuff like that. So you even though I had the training in the 30, I have to keep on going back and you kind of get like retrained in the newest techniques and so forth. So that's what some of these officers do with Spectre, is they're coming out and they're taking courses that are like next level of what you've been trained in, and then other techniques. And don't forget, I've been doing it for like 35 years. I've made a lot of mistakes over the years too.
Uh-huh.
So my course, I kind of streamline that and help you cut your mistakes right out. I'm going to tell you how to not to make them, because I've already learned. So a lot of my techniques are how to do the work, and sometimes having less equipment than you think. And a great example of that is we have fuming chambers upstairs where you fume super glue for how do you do an ATM, a car, or a safe. I teach them how to build fuming chambers with PVC pipe out in the garage, and you can do the fuming for larger items too.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. And I think that it's, you know, that professional development and that hands-on training, you know, really does make a difference. It makes a difference in not only cold cases, but it probably makes a difference, you know, in any investigation.
Correct.
Right? You want to know how to
Correct.
Do it right. Well, believe it or not, we're out of time, Lieutenant, and this has been a very interesting, you know, conversation, and I appreciate you sharing your expertise and some of your intriguing cold cases with us, and I guess my best piece of advice is keep up the good work.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Lieutenant Art Weisberger with the Norwalk Police Department and Spectre Criminal Justice Training, thanks for being with us, and thanks to all of you for tuning in to this edition of News You Can Use right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.
The Recap Show is an inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.